Thank you, Dr. Moore, and thank all of you for coming out again to interact with us on this important subject. Yesterday, when Dr. Moore made mention of the use of my textbook here by some of you, I thought back to about 2 years ago when I was in Columbia, South Carolina, at what I think they call now Columbia International University, and there were several of us there for Evangelical Theological Society. So at chapel time, several authors, Andreas Kostenberger and several others, and I, who had written books, were asked to stand, and they read off the list of the books. And then they asked the students who had been in courses where those books were required as textbooks to stand. And there was quite a number of them. Now, what I wanted to do was to get up and say, now, all of those of you who were in those courses where the textbooks were required, who read the book, please sit down. But I restrained myself, and I'm restraining myself from doing that here as well. But I usually say, if all the students in courses that use my textbook were placed end-to-end, they would be much more comfortable. We want to talk today about perhaps more difficult and more obscure subject. I presented a paper on somewhat this topic a few years ago at Evangelical Theological Society, and my wife asked me, as she does in advance, what are you going to say? So I gave her a sort of a synopsis of it. And she said, no one will understand what you're talking about. Well, some people did, at least enough to ask questions. But I fear that someday when I work on a topic like this, my wife, who is well-educated, has a master's degree, and is a very intelligent person and a good thinker, will decide that I have finally lost my mind. So if you hear that I have been committed to an institution, not an educational institution, by my wife, you'll understand why. But thanks for coming to wrestle along with us on this. We're not talking about whether any of the content of our theology can be derived from physics or any of these other disciplines, but whether, in this particular case, whether there are any developments in this area of science that might give us models that might be helpful in understanding some concepts from Scripture. Bearing in mind that these are humanly constructed models, they therefore are dispensable. We should feel free to replace them with others. They're nothing inspired. They are not of the nature of authority of the concept that we are trying to utilize them to model, but they might be useful to us. And there are two areas in which I want us to sort of think together this morning. And the first pertains to the concept of hyperspace, which I'll explain in a moment, especially as related to the question of miracles, but it may have implications in some other areas as well. The question of miracles is one of perennial discussion, because miracles, by their nature, appear to be contradictory to the usual functioning of nature. That's why they tend to be called miracles. They are unusual, they attract the attention, they are something that you wouldn't expect to happen. And there are different theories that have been formulated about the relationship between biblical miracles and natural law, so-called, the usual, regular functioning of nature. And basically, there are three concepts or three theories that have been formulated. One is that miracles simply break the laws of nature, that somehow the laws of nature are violated by these. One is to say that miracles don't break the laws of nature, but that they are the functioning of sort of deeper, unknown laws of nature. If we fully understood nature, there wouldn't be anything remarkable about this. It's just a very rare kind of occurrence that doesn't usually happen. The third is that these are neither suspensions of the laws of nature nor the manifestations of unusual versions of the law of nature, but that the laws of nature still function. For example, in the case of the axe head floating, the law of gravity is still functioning, but that God supernaturally introduced a force which countered the effect, as if the hand of God was holding up the axe head, which is being equally attracted, of course, by the object, the larger object, in this case, the Earth. I'd like to suggest that we take a look at this development in the area of physics and see if it might fit somewhere within this. Hyperspace is another way of speaking of a concept now being spoken of by some physicists, which speaks of multiple dimensions of space. We've become accustomed to thinking of three spatial dimensions, and since Einstein, a fourth dimension, that of time. But now some people in the field of quantum mechanics are talking about perhaps 10 spatial dimensions. Now that immediately is difficult for us to conceive. Literally difficult to conceive, because we can't form a mental picture of that, can we? We've never experienced that. But the physicists tell us that seems to be a psychological problem that we have. But mathematically, these additional dimensions can be described and can be discussed. I was on a panel one time at Evangelical Theological Society along with Hugh Ross and another theologian and another philosopher. And Ross, a scientist who's worked in this kind of area, was discussing this type of thing. And he said, given this theory of multiple dimensions, it would be possible to turn a basketball inside out without breaking it. Now, this completely befuddled the philosopher on our panel, because he could not form a mental picture of it, couldn't conceive of how this could be. It was simply dismissed. The physicist says we cannot form a mental picture of it, but if we can describe mathematically these things, then these are possibilities. Now suppose, then, that there are not just two and not just three, but four, five, six, or more physical dimensions of space. And let's simply, for practical purposes, think of it as four. But let's think first of the possibility of two-dimensional creatures, the flatlanders, they are sometimes called. They are simply two-dimensional. You could imprison a two-dimensional creature by simply drawing a circle around it, because he couldn't get out. Being two-dimensional, that would restrict him. But then, says the physicist, suppose a three-dimensional creature came along. The three-dimensional creature could simply reach into those two dimensions, pluck that two-dimensional creature out, and place him outside that circle. It would appear to the two-dimensional being a miracle. It could not happen according to the laws of reality as he knew them. Now, says the physicist, suppose we take three-dimensional beings, such as you and I are. And suppose there is a four-dimensional being. That four-dimensional being, coming from the fourth dimension, could perform what would appear to us three-dimensional beings as a miracle. An interesting little book, and I think one of the clearer ones that deals with this, one by Michio Kaku entitled Hyperspace, A Scientific Odyssey Through Parallel Universes, Time Warps, and the Tenth Dimension. And he has a chapter, interestingly to me at least, entitled To Be a God. Now, I don't know anything about his personal theological beliefs, if he has any, but this is the title he gives to the chapter. And he says this: imagine being able to walk through walls. You wouldn't have to bother with opening doors. You could pass right through them. You wouldn't have to go around buildings. You could enter them through their walls and pillars and out through the back wall. You wouldn't have to detour around mountains. You could step right into them. When hungry, you could reach through the refrigerator door without opening it. You could never be accidentally locked outside your car. You could simply step through the car door. Imagine being able to disappear or reappear at will. Instead of driving to school or work, you could just vanish and rematerialize in your classroom or office. Imagine having X-ray eyes. You'd be able to see accidents happening at a distance. After vanishing and rematerializing at the scene of any accident, you could see exactly where the victims were, even if they were hidden under debris. Now, he says, this is how it would be if you were four-dimensional in a three-dimensional world. And such power, he points out, could be used either for great good or great evil. A surgeon in the fourth dimension could repair damaged organs without breaking the skin or without cutting the tissue. We hear about microsurgery and arthroscopic surgery and so on. This would take it one step further. He'd simply remove the organ, replace it with another one of his organ transplant, or repair it, and never have to break the skin. There'd be really no recovery time. On the other hand, a criminal, well, let's say a thief, could enter a heavily guarded bank. He could see into the vault, determine what's there, reach through the door of the vault to take out the valuables, and as he fled, bullets fired at him by guards or police would pass right through his body without harming him. Then Kaku draws this conclusion. What being would possess such godlike power? The answer, a being from a higher dimensional world. Of course, these feats are beyond the capability of any three-dimensional person. For us, walls are solid and prison bars are unbreakable. Attempting to walk through walls will only give us a painful bloody nose. But for a four-dimensional being, such feats would be child's play. Now, bear in mind that this is speculative and this is controversial even among physicists. But suppose this particular theory is true, that there are dimensions beyond the three spatial ones. And suppose that God is four or more dimensional being, that he comes from another dimension than the ones we know. I looked at some scriptures in a little different way after reading to be a God. For example, John chapter 20, verse 19. We do have some scripture. Yesterday there were none. On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be unto you." Or Luke 4, 28 to 30. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him, that is Jesus, out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him down the hill. But he walked right through the crowd and went on his way. Now, I am not claiming that the theory of multiple spatial dimensions or hyperspace is true, or that this is some final way to explain miracles, but it does provide us with one potentially useful way to think of how miracles may occur. Now, unfortunately, theologians and philosophers of religion have been rather slow to even explore these kinds of possibilities. And I've been disappointed in some such theologians, specifically people who work in the area of theology and science. For example, Nancy Murphy of Fuller Seminary, who has two doctorates, one of which is in the philosophy of science. In her discussion of miracles, she is critical of concepts like a divine force countering the effects of natural forces, that third theory I propounded. Yet surprisingly, she never raises the question of this hyperspace theory in relationship to this. Or I think of another theologian, again a woman, who teaches theology and science at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. And at one meeting in the American Theological Society, at dinner, was seated next to her. It was interesting because she's a German who's lived in Sweden. So we had portions of our conversation in each of three languages, which was rather taxing. I was glad to go back to English. But I asked her about this particular development in physics, and it was as if I had spoken to her in yet a fourth language, which she did not know. Now, I'm not, again, not saying this is some final solution to the question, but it's one possibility worth thinking about. There may be other areas besides miracles in which this might give us some insight. For example, Jeremiah 23:23, Am I only a God nearby, declares the Lord, and not a God far away? Without being aware of this particular development of physics, obviously, since he died 150 years before these theories were propounded, the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard spoke of transcendence as dimensional beyondness, being in another dimension. I don't think he was speaking of it in that technical sense, but this might be one way in which God transcends by being outside of our dimensions and yet is able to be active within it. Or Acts chapter 1, verses 9 to 11. By the way, the concept and the doctrine of Jesus' ascension is one of the most neglected ones in evangelical theology. There really isn't such a doctrine. For the most part, just he went to heaven. But the meaning of it, I do not find much explored. But Acts 1, 9-11, after he, Jesus, said this, he was taken up before their very eyes, and a cloud hid him from their sight. They were looking intently up into the sky as he was going, when suddenly two men dressed in white stood beside them. Men of Galilee, they said, why do you stand here looking into the sky? This same Jesus who has been taken from you into heaven will come back in the same way you have seen him go into heaven. Perhaps the transition to heaven is a movement out of our three dimensions into other dimensions in which God dwells. Or 1 Corinthians 15, that difficult passage where Paul talks about a spiritual body, verse 35 and then 42 to 44. Someone will ask, how are the dead raised? With what kind of body will they come? So will it be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable, it is raised imperishable. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. Could the theory of hyperspace be a possible insight into what is involved? I don't know, but it's a possibility. Perhaps there is something to be said here in terms of what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 2:9. However, it is written, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. Perhaps this is of help in some other areas as well. The difficult topic of the relationship between human freedom and divine sovereignty. If you want to list the problems that are most logically difficult to wrestle with in theology, they'd be the incarnation and the Trinity and this one of human freedom and divine sovereignty. Paul wrote this, Philippians 2:12. Therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you both to will and to act according to his good purpose. Could it be that God, working from a different dimension, is able to interact with us? And may there even be some possible insight into the indwelling of Christ in the believer and the working of the Holy Spirit in the life of the believer. John 15:4, remain in me and I will remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I am in the vine, you are the branches. If a man remains in me, and I in him, he will bear much fruit, for apart from me you can do nothing. Or John 14:16-17. I will ask the Father, and he will give you another counselor to be with you forever, the Spirit of truth. The world cannot accept him because it neither sees him nor knows him, but you know him, for he lives with you and will be in you. Or Paul's famous statement, which has become a life motto for a lot of people, Galatians 2:20. I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. We have often had difficulty with concepts like this, and we still do and still will. Part of it stems, I think, from our realization that two physical objects can't occupy the same space. You see that demonstrated quite frequently when automobile accidents take place. You also see it on the football field quite dramatically demonstrated sometimes. Two physical objects can't occupy the same space. But perhaps if the theory of hyperspace is true, there are other possibilities that may have some modeling effect in some areas of our theological conceptions. Now, there's another area that I want us to pursue. The nature of the future and some scientific ideas related to the nature of time. Now, let me sketch briefly the context in which this problem has arisen. You are, I'm sure, familiar on this campus with the debate that's taken place over the nature of divine foreknowledge, the nature and extent of it, and the open theism controversy, to which one of your professors, Dr. Ware, has contributed one of the finest treatments in his examining of the shortcomings of the open theist view. One of the interesting questions that was posed by that related to the status of the future. And the question, do statements about the future have truth value? By that I do not mean simply, are statements about the future true? The question is, are statements about the future either true or false? Because one of the nuances of the open theist argument by particularly Greg Boyd and John Sanders has been this, that statements about the future are neither true nor false because there is no reality to which they could correspond. The future has no reality. And I think it's Sanders who describes it as being like a carpet on a carpeting roll. When you go into a carpeting store, there's the carpeting on big rolls. And they roll off as much as you want to buy, and then they cut off a portion. Now, time is like that, says the argument. And the traditional view is the present is the point at which the carpeting is coming off the roll, and the future is somewhere wound inside there waiting to be unrolled. But says the open theist, no, there's nothing there until the future occurs or until the present occurs. There isn't anything there already existing. It simply has to come into being. And so we get the interesting phenomenon of someone saying, I believe in the inerrancy of statements about the future. They are not false. They also are not true because there is nothing to which they could correspond. That is a somewhat unusual concept to assimilate because most of us have used inerrant as one of the ways of expressing everything the Bible says is true. But this says it's inerrant because it's not false, but it also isn't true. You have to ask yourself about the particular use of language in that case. I'm sure somewhere some presidential candidate will find a way to use that kind of a logic, but that's another story. But says Boyd, for example, the statement, there is a monkey sitting next to me, isn't false, isn't true because there's no monkey there, but that does not mean there's anything by way of shortcoming of it. So if God makes a statement about something that is to happen, it isn't false, it isn't true, the future has no reality at all, and therefore God can't know it. Just as God's omnipotence doesn't mean he can do the logically impossible. God's omnipotence doesn't mean he can make square circles, for example. But that's not a limitation on his omnipotence. So God's omniscience doesn't mean that he can know the future because there's nothing there to know either, just as square circles can't exist. So the argument is the future has no reality, and therefore God's inability to know it is not a problem. It's not an inability. There is simply, it's a nonsense statement. Now, there are several ways to come at this that are supplied to us by some contemporary thinking in physics. And one of them is the older derivation of the paradox of simultaneity that comes from Einstein. I was first introduced to this not under that terminology, as a young boy on the farm watching our neighbor chopping wood one day. He was, I suppose, about 200 yards away. And this, I don't know what age I was, quite young. This was the first time that I had noticed this phenomenon, that I saw his axe hit the wood, and then there was an interval, and I heard the sound of it. Later, my parents taught me how to estimate how far away a lightning strike took place. After you see the flash, when you see the flash, start counting, 1,001, 1,002, and if it's 5 seconds, it's a mile away. If before you get to 1,001, you hear the boom, look out. But that was simply the phenomenon of the difference in the speed of light and of sound. Now the question happens, when did it, the event of the chopping actually occur? When did that chop actually occur? When I heard it, when I saw it, when my neighbor heard it, when my neighbor saw it. Now bear in mind, he was probably 3 or 4 feet, his ears and eyes, from the point of impact, so that the delay was negligible, but there was a slight delay there either. Slight delay there as well. Now, when you begin to extend this out, begin to think about it, you realize that light and sound are radiating outward into space. And somewhere, we measure distance, of course, scientists do, by light years. That's a measure of distance. How far light will travel in 1 year. Somewhere, let's see, 63 light years and 9 light months out in space, it's D-Day. And the Allies are invading the beaches of Normandy. If you could be out there, and it was clear enough at the time, and that's why the invasion took place when it did. There was a brief clearing with the English Channel, and could look back, and of course, lights could be spread pretty widely. You could watch the D-Day invasion. You'd need a very powerful telescope, but you could do it. We don't see the light from the sun when it rises immediately, do we? And when we see the light from a star 5 light years away, we are seeing the light that emanated from that star 5 years ago. So the question arises then, what about what's really simultaneous with what? You say, well, now that works because going backward, the cone of radiation goes out that way. But some people, such as Stephen Hawking, have said, but the cone of radiation goes the other way as well. In other words, that it goes into the future. And that in theory, if God is at the other end of the cone, he looks back and sees the things that to us have not yet occurred, but from his perspective have already occurred. Now that's a fairly simple one, but there are some more interesting versions. And I won't talk about the Big Bang. There are some implications of that, too. I'm more interested in wormholes. For some time now, we've heard about black holes, which are places of such intense gravitational pull that nothing can escape from them, including light, and so that's why they are black. At the center of these, or within them, is something called a singularity, a place of intense gravitational pull. Now, the problem is that anything that would come near a black hole would immediately be destroyed, be sucked in, it would be crushed by that intense force of gravity. But if there were some other possibilities, said physicist Roy Kerr of New Zealand, if, for example, the opening of that black hole were rotating, then there would be the possibility of something entering the black hole and emerging in a different place. Back in 1989, Carl Sagan, himself a scientist, was writing a science fiction novel. And he wanted to dress it up with what he called some scientific-sounding mumbo-jumbo to make it sound plausible. So he contacted his friend Kip Thorne, a physicist at the California Institute of Technology, and said, can you come up with some plausible-sounding and fairly scientifically respectable language for me to use here? Well, Thorne did what all good professors do. He assigned it to two of his doctoral students, Michael Morris and Alvi Yurtsever. And like good doctoral students hoping to obtain their PhD, they went to work on it. They began to build on the work of Einstein and Nathan Rosen, who had said, really, black holes have two ends, and they are joined by something which came to be called, interestingly, the Einstein-Rosen bridge. And instead of starting as it had usually been done, these two graduate students, I guess wanting to impress the doctoral mentor, started at the other end. The usual approach had been to say, let's take a look at physical objects and ask what are the characteristics of them that would permit travel in space, through space, not just traveling at something less than the speed of light, but going from here to there by a leap, as it were, through a conduit. And they decided that they would instead start at the other end with a mathematical model of what mathematically would be required for something to be moved from one spot to another. Space travel was all they were talking about at this point. And they concluded that they could work with a model that mathematically said there is nothing in this concept of space travel that contradicts any of the known laws of physics. And so they submitted to Sagan, and he worked it into his novel. They had not thought of applying this idea to time travel, but Thorne and Morris were at a professional society and were presenting this concept, and one of the persons attending said, you know, that would work not only with space travel, but with time travel as well. And now, instead of just novels on space travel, there came to be novels on time travel, in which the idea was of wormholes, in which you have one end of a black hole anchored in the present, and you drag the other end to another place or another time. And in theory, you could enter one end of this wormhole in one place and one time and come out the other end at a different place and or a different time. Now, there are certain problems with this. The first is this problem of singularity. You get the spaceship in there and it's going to be crushed by the gravity. But as Currid pointed out, if the opening is rotating, then the rotation counteracts the gravitational pull. Secondly, an electrical charge on the wormhole, this stretched out two ends of the black hole, offsets the gravitation. And the third was the presence of exotic matter. Exotic matter is anti-gravity or negative energy or matter, not anti-matter. But for those of you who are familiar in physics, the Casimir effect. I won't try to go into that in detail, but these were the possibilities that would solve that idea that the intense gravity would crush anything. But there was a second problem with the idea that we could travel through time this way, and that is that a spaceship entering such a black hole or a wormhole would generate waves in front of it. That would have any accelerating object would generate these. You do it with an automobile, whether you're aware of it or not. But that this ripple effect would encounter those gravity waves. They would be amplified to infinity by a bounce back, so it was amplified each time, and that would warp space-time so you couldn't get through. But it was pointed out something could be developed, something like white noise. Those of you who are familiar with white noise, I don't own one of these devices, but I am sorely tempted to buy one. And if there's been discussion about allowing the use of cell phones on airplanes while in flight, if that goes through, I will certainly buy a white noise device. to get some peace and quiet somewhere, you know. But what a white noise device does is to send out a sound wave that counters by a sort of an inverse effect the sound wave, so it just sort of neutralizes it. And a similar type of thing could be done with these gravitational waves. There's one other problem, and it is quite a serious problem. The amount of power that would be involved, be required to develop a wormhole through which you could travel. In order to open a wormhole, 1 nanometer, 1 billionth of a meter in diameter, would require 1/10 of the daily power output of a sun-sized star, which means that to open a hole 1 meter in diameter, I mean, you're going to have to bend over to go through that, or you're going to have a small spaceship, but would take the daily power output of 50 trillion stars the size of our sun, which exceeds any amount of power available or likely to be available to humans in the foreseeable future. So even, Virgin Atlantic Airways, which is now scheduling flights to the moon, is not likely to schedule time travel for a while. But if you see you had a being with infinite resources of power, then it's no problem. What seems to be the present and the future are not as real. In other words, time isn't, as we have thought of it, perhaps quite as real as we have thought. There is an asymmetrical dimension to this theory. It would be possible to go from the present to any point in the future. It would only be possible to go backward to a point at which or after which traversable wormholes have been developed, which explains, since I'm sure you've been wondering, why we haven't had any visitors from the future yet, because we haven't invented or developed traversable wormholes. But in theory, you see, the physicist says there is nothing really in the laws of physics that would prohibit traveling from one time to another. Now, there's one other interesting concept, interesting to me at least. I'm not sure if it is to you. The unreality of time. Hugh Price at the University of Sydney, Australia, came up with the idea that the concept that the past is not influenced by the present or by what is future to it, which we have tended to hold, that nothing I can do today will affect the past. That's just sort of common sense. But Price said that is an anthropomorphic illusion. It is, quote, a projection of our own atemporal symmetry. The fact that we're going to see tomorrow, if we're alive, but we'll never see yesterday again. We live forwards. He says we have projected that anthropomorphically. He says many of the puzzles of physics can be solved by the idea that signals from the future, that's his terminology, play a part in determining the outcome of quantum experiments. He works with the idea of what he calls retarded waves and advanced waves. Now, I don't know, somebody is probably going to get him in difficulty with the use of retarded waves. It is not politically correct, but I'm sorry, that's the language that he uses, in which he says, imagine an electromagnetic wave moving out from a particle in the present into the future at the speed of light. And another theory describing the movement of a wave from the future converging upon that particle at the speed of light. This is the retarded wave and the advanced wave. And some physicists have picked this up and have developed it. For example, John Kramer has recently investigated the idea. And he says, in quantum theory, an entity such as an electron that's about to be involved in an interaction may send out what he terms an offer wave to the future. And the particle that the electron is about to interact with receives the offer wave and sends back a response in time from the future to the first electron. And this advanced and retarded wave have a handshake. Now, you're familiar probably if you were still using dial-up internet access or using fax machines, the handshake that takes place. When I first got internet access, which was 1993, my wife said, "What's that sound?" I said, "That's my modem speaking to the modem at the University of Minnesota." She said, "What are they saying?" I said, "Mine is saying, I want to talk to you." And the other one is saying, "All right, what speed?" 48K. I wasn't that then, probably 28K. "I can do that. How many bits?" "One." "Let's go." That's all that. Beep, 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 boom, boom. That's the handshake. They are conversing. They are negotiating. Computer scientists actually use that terminology. They're negotiating a connection. Now, it's something like that, says Kramer. This electron, about to interact with another electron, sends out an offer wave, and the other electron sends back a response wave, and they have a handshake. That the possibility allowed by the other electron determines what would happen. Now, I won't go into the technical dimensions of this, but Price says, what does this mean then? Does it mean the things we do in the present that don't seem to affect the past, that perhaps the past can be affected by this? And here's what he says. Those of you familiar with the thought of William of Ockham will hear a parallel in physics to his theology here. He says, if this is the case, then the past has already taken account of what we are doing in the present, and if we decide something differently now, then the past, having taken that into account, knowing what we are going to do, is different than it would otherwise have been. Now, this may seem mind-blowing to some of us, but what we have here is a possibility of a way of understanding, from standpoint of physics, the nature of time, that it does not necessarily have the kind of status that we do. We have usually thought of the foreknowledge concept as if God looks ahead at the future and sees what is going to happen. My postdoctoral mentor, Wolfhard Pannenberg, refers to this as a grossly anthropomorphic picture of God peering down through the future. Perhaps, unlike us, the locus of God's existence is not the present. Perhaps, as Pannenberg and Moltmann and other theologians of hope put it, perhaps the locus of God's existence is in what we call the future. Perhaps God doesn't foresee what's going to happen in our future. Perhaps God remembers what is for us future, but from his perspective is already past. A different way of looking at time in which God sees and knows that which to us is yet unknown because it hasn't occurred, but to him is already in effect the past. Now, I don't know if this particular theory is true or is genuine or is valid or is applicable, but after I looked at that, I took out my scriptures and turned to the book of Revelation, and I thought this: I am Alpha and Omega, says the scripture, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Perhaps we have focused too much in our thinking about God and time on the first of those. I am the Alpha, I am the first, I am the beginning. Maybe, prodded a little bit by some of the quantum mechanics physicists, we would be encouraged to think more about God as the Omega, the last, and the end. Maybe that analogy we've used of the parade needs to be revised. Some of you remember that. It's probably in your theology book or in your theology lecture, in which on what's called the atemporalist view of God, God is someone who sits upon a high steeple watching a parade. Incidentally, when Arnold Houston was going to revise and condense Christian theology into introducing Christian doctrine, he tried out this concept on his undergraduate students. The concept of a church steeple, at least in Minnesota, was so foreign to them that he had to modify it to the idea of God sitting up on a very high piece of ground somewhere. But on this analogy, those seated alongside or standing alongside the route of the parade see the parade come by bit, and the float that is passing them at that moment, that's the present. But on that analogy, God sits where he can see the whole parade from beginning to end. But maybe, says this analogy, the whole parade has already gone by because it's God who has designed it and God who has ordained it. And he already sees not only the beginning of the parade, but sees the very end. The whole parade, all of history from his perspective, in one sense, has already gone by. Are there possibilities here? I think there are. I'm not willing to stake my theological reputation on them. I caution against too closely committing oneself to say, now we've got the right explanation, because this will be revived by something else. But maybe some of the work by physicists, who, by the way, are doing the best work in the area of metaphysics, much better than most philosophers, maybe some of the work of the concept they are producing may give us different ways to think of God's relationship to the dimensions within which events occur and therefore acts miraculously. Maybe they give us some new concepts regarding the nature of time and therefore how God knows what we call the future. We are in the process of using our minds to understand God. We will never fully understand God, at least within this life. And I suspect when we get to heaven and see God for the first time, we'll say, oh, that's so clear. Why couldn't I understand that before? And I'm looking forward, for example, to seeing or hearing Paul give the definitive lecture on predestination and saying, why? Clear as can be. But maybe as we attempt with our minds to love God not only with our hearts and souls and strength, but our minds as well, and seek to understand him, maybe there are some insights that are of help to us here. May God bless us in that endeavor.